Chapter 15. The darkness drew back, each minute enlarging the circle of their vision. Now the upper works of the bridge stood out, a neat geometrical pattern against the dark bulk of the heights. Then he could see the patterns of dark bush against pale grass and rock. The new light distorted distance, made the high ground seem remote and no longer hostile. A flight of egrets flew in long formation above the course of the river, high enough to catch the sun so that they were birds of bright, glowing gold in a world of shadow, and the dawn brought with it a small, cold wind whose voice in the grass blended with the murmur of the river. Then the sun hit the heights, as though to bless the army of the Republic. The mist in the gullies writhed in agony at its warmth, lifted into the wind and smeared away. The rim of the sun pushed up over the edge of the land, and the day came bright and clean with dew. Through his glasses, Shaun studied the crest of the high ground. At 100 paces there were traces of smoke as the Boer army brewed coffee. "You think they'll spot us?" asked Saul. Shaun shook his head without lowering his glasses. Two small bushes and the thin screen of grass they had constructed during the night hid them effectively. "Are you sure you're all right?" Saul asked once more. From the set of his face, Shaun seemed to be in pain. "Stomach gripes," Shaun grunted. "Let it start soon, please, let it start. The waiting is the worst." Then the ground trembled under his chest, the faintest vibration, and Shaun felt relief flood through him. "Here come the guns," he said, and using the cover of one of the bushes, he stood up and looked behind him. In a single column, following each other at strictly spaced intervals, the guns were moving into action. They were coming in fast, still tiny with distance but growing as the gunners astride the lead horses of each team urged them on. Closer now, so that Shaun could see the whip arms rising and falling, he heard the rumble and rattle of the carriages and faintly the shouts of the outriders. 16 guns, 150 horses to drag them, and 100 men to serve them. But in the vastness of the great plain before Colenso, the column seemed small and insignificant. Shaun looked beyond them and saw the foot soldiers following them, line upon line like the poles of a fence, thousands of them, creeping forward across the plain. Shaun felt the old wild elation begin. He knew the army was centred upon the line of markers which he and Saul had laid early the previous night, and that the two of them would be the first to cross the bridge, the first of all those thousands. But it was elation of a different quality to anything he had experienced before. It was sharper and more poignant, seasoned by the red pepper of his fear. So that for the first time in his life, Shaun learned that fear can be a pleasurable sensation. He watched the patterns of men and guns evolve upon the brown gaming table, counters thrown down at chance, to be won or irretrievably lost at the fall of the dice of war. Knowing also that he was one of the counters, afraid and strangely jubilant in this knowledge. The guns were close now. He could make sense of the shouting, see the features of the men, and even recognize his own feelings in their faces. Close, perhaps too close, uneasily Shaun glanced back at the forbidding heights beyond the river and gauged the range. 2,000 yards, perhaps? Long rifle shot. And still the guns came on. "Jesus Christ, are they mad?" Shaun asked aloud. "They must engage now," Saul also saw the danger. "They can't come closer." And still the guns came on. The sound of their charge was low thunder. Dust from the dew-damp earth rose reluctantly behind them, horses with wide mouths throwing froth as they drove against the traces. "They're in range now. They must stop. They must," groaned Shaun. Then at last the column splayed open. Alternate guns wheeling, left and right, still at full gallop, swinging broadside to the waiting Boer rifles. "My God, my God!" Shaun mouthed the blasphemy, in agony as he watched. "They'll be massacred!" Gunners rising in the stirrups, leaning back to check the carriages, the gun captains jumping from their mounts, letting them gallop free as they ran to begin the unhitching and the pointing. In this helpless moment, while men swarmed over the guns, manhandling them to train upon the heights, while the horses still reared and whinnied in hysterical excitement, before the shells could be unloaded and stacked beside their pieces, in that moment the Boer rifles opened together. It was a sound that lacked violence, strangely unwarlike, muted by distance, to the popping of 100 strings of fireworks. And at first there was no effect. The grass was thick enough to hide the strike of the bullets, the dust too lazy with dew to jump and mark their fall. Then a horse was hit and fell kicking, dragging its mate onto its knees also. Two men ran to cut it loose, but one of them never reached it. He sat down suddenly in the grass with his head bowed. Two more horses dropped, another reared and pawed wildly at the air, with one front leg flapping loosely where a bullet had broken the bone above the knee. "Get out!" roared Sean. "Pull back while there's still time!" But his voice did not carry to the gun crews, could not carry above the shouting and the screaming of wounded horses. There was a new sound now, which Sean could not identify, a sound like hail on a tin roof, isolated at first, then more frequent, until it was 100 hammers clanging together in broken rhythm, and he knew it was the sound of bullets striking the metal of the guns. He saw a gunner fall forward and jam the breech of the piece until he was dragged clear, a loader drop the shell he was carrying and stumble on with his legs folding until he subsided and lay still. One of the horses break loose and gallop across the plain, dragging a tangle of torn traces behind it. A covey of wild pheasant rise together out of the grass near the batteries and curve away along the river before dropping on stiff wings back into cover. And behind the guns, the infantry in neat lines advancing placidly towards the huddle of deserted cottages that was Colenso. Then, with a crash that made the earth jump, and with 16 long spurts of blue smoke, the guns came into action. Sean focused his glasses on the ridge in time to see the first shells burst along the crest. The evil blossoms of greenish-yellow lyddite fumes bloomed quickly in the sunlight, then drifted oily thick on the wind. Again the guns crashed, and again each salvo more ragged than the last, until it became a continuous stuttering, hammering roar, until the stark outline of the ridge was blurred and indefinite in the dust and lyddite fumes. There was smoke also, a fine greyish mist of it banked along the heights, the smoke of thousands of rifles. Quickly Sean set the rear sight of his Lee Metford at 1,000 yards, wriggled forward on his elbows, hunched down over his rifle, and began shooting blindly into the smoke on the heights. Beside him Saul was firing also. Twice Sean emptied his magazine before looking back at the guns. The tempo of their fire had slackened. Most of the horses were down in the grass. Dead men were draped across the gun carriages. Others, badly wounded, crouched for cover behind the mountings. And where 6 men had served each piece before, now 4 or only 3 carried shell and loaded and fired. "The fools, the bloody fools," Sean whispered, and began to shoot again, concentrating his whole attention on the routine of jerking the bolt back, sliding it forward in the same motion, sighting up into the mist of gun smoke, and firing. He did not count the shots, and each time the weapon clicked empty, he groped for another clip from his bandolier and reloaded. He was starting to sweat now, could feel it trickling down his armpits. His ears buzzed from the concussion of the rifle, and his shoulder was beginning to throb. Gradually, a sense of unreality induced by the clamour of the guns and the smell of burnt powder came over him. It seemed that all he would ever do was lie and shoot at nothing, shoot at smoke. Then reality faded further, so that all of existence was the V and dot of a rifle sight, standing solid in mist, and the mist had no shape. In his ears was the vast buzzing silence that drowned all the other sounds of battle. He was alone and tranquil, heavy and dulled by the hypnotic drift of smoke and the repetitive act of loading and firing. Abruptly the mood was broken. Over them passed a rustle like giant wings, then a crack as though Satan had slammed the door of hell. Startled, he looked up and saw a ball of shimmering white smoke standing in the air above the guns, spinning and spreading, growing in the sky like a flower. "What the—" "Shrapnel," grunted Saul. "Now they're finished." Then crack and crack again as the Boer Nordenfelts planted their cotton flowers of smoke above the plain, flailing the guns and the men who still worked them with a buzzing, hissing storm of steel. Then there were voices, confused and dazed by the gunfire. It took Sean a minute to place them. He had forgotten the infantry. "Close up there. Close up on the right. Keep the line. Don't run. Steady, men. Don't run." long lines of men, lines that bulged and lagged and straightened again at the urging of their officers, evenly spaced, plodding quietly with their rifles held across their chests. They passed the guns. Behind them they left khaki bundles lying on the plain. Some of the bundles lay still, but others writhed and screamed. As the gaps appeared in the lines, they were quickly filled at the chant of, close up there on the flank. They're heading for the railway bridge. Sean felt the first premonition of disaster. Don't they know that it's been destroyed? Or we'll have to stop them. Saul scrambled to his feet beside Sean. Why didn't the fools follow our markers? Angrily, Sean shouted the question that had no answer. He did it to gain time, to postpone the moment when he must leave the flimsy cover of the grass shelter and go out into the open where the shrapnel and the Mausers swept the ground. Sean's fear came back to him strongly. He didn't want to go out there. Come on, Sean, we must stop them. And Saul started to run. He looked like a skinny little monkey capering out towards the advancing waves of foot soldiers. Sean sucked in his breath and held it a moment before he followed. 20 yards ahead of the leading rank of infantry, carrying a naked sword in one hand and stepping out briskly on long legs, came an officer. Hey, you! Sean shouted at him, waving his hat to catch his attention. He succeeded. The officer fixed him with bright blue eyes like a pair of bayonets, and the waxed points of his grey moustache twitched. He strode on towards Sean and Paul. You're heading for the wrong bridge, Sean yelled at him, his voice high-pitched with agitation. They've blown the rail bridge. You'll never get across there. The officer reached them and checked his stride. And who the hell are you, if it's not a rude question? We're the ground scouts, Sean started, then leapt in the air as a Mauser bullet flicked into the ground between his legs. And put that bloody sword away. You'll have every Boer on the Tugela competing for you. The officer, a colonel by the crowns on his shoulders, frowned at Sean. The correct form of address, Sergeant. The hell with that, Sean roared at him. Swing your advance onto the road bridge. He pointed with agitation at the metal superstructure of the bridge that showed on the left through the thorn trees. If you continue as you're going, they'll cut you to pieces. A moment longer, the colonel fixed Sean with his bayonet eyes. Then he lifted a silver whistle to his lips and blew a piercing blast. Take cover, he shouted. Take cover. And immediately the first rank dropped into the grass. Behind them the other ranks lost their rigidity as men hesitated. Get into the town, the voice shouted. Take cover in the buildings. And they broke and ran, 1,000 men jostling each other, racing for the security of the cottages of Colenso, pouring into the single street, diving into doorways and windows. Within 30 seconds they had all gone to ground. Now what is this all about? Demanded the colonel, turning back to Sean. Impatiently, Sean repeated himself, standing out in the open and uncomfortably aware that, for absence of other targets, the Boers were beginning to take a very active interest in them. Are you sure? Damn it, of course I'm sure. The bridge is destroyed, and they have torn up all the barbed wire fences and thrown them into the river. You'll never get across there. Come along, the colonel set off towards the nearest cottage, and Sean walked beside him. Afterwards, he was never certain how he had managed to cover that 100 yards without running. For God's sake, put that sword away, he growled at the colonel, as they walked with the flit-spang of bullets around them. Nervous, Sergeant. And for the first time, the colonel grinned. You're damned right I am. So am I. But it would never do to let the men see that, would it? He steadied the scabbard on his hips and then ran the sword back into it. What's your name, Sergeant? Sean Courtney, Natal Corps of Guides. What's yours? Sean ducked instinctively as a bullet cracked past his head, and the colonel smiled again at the familiarity. Aitchison, John Aitchison, 2nd Battalion, Scots Fusiliers. And they reached the cottage. No longer able to restrain himself, Sean dived thankfully through the kitchen door and found Saul already there. He handed Sean a cheroot and held a match for him. These crazy soties, he observed. And you're as bad as he is, strolling around in the middle of a battle. Right, Courtney, Aitchison followed him into the kitchen. Let's go over the situation. He listened quietly while Sean explained in detail. He had to shout to lift his voice above the whistle and crack of the Boer artillery and the roar of 1,000 Lee Metford rifles as they replied from the windows and doorways of the village. Around them, the kitchen was being used as a dressing station, and the moan and whimper of wounded men added to the hubbub of battle. When Sean had finished, Aitchison turned away and strode to the window. He looked out across the railway tracks to where the guns stood. They were drawn up in precise parade ground formation, but now they were silent. Dribbling back towards the shelter of a deep donga or gully in the rear, the surviving gunners dragged their wounded with them. "Poor bastards," Sean whispered, as he saw one of the retreating gunners killed, shot in the head, so that his helmet was thrown spinning upwards in a brief pink cloud of blood. The sight seemed to rouse Aitchison, too. "All right," he said. "We'll advance on the road bridge. Come on, Courtney." Behind him, somebody cried out, and Sean heard him fall. But he did not look round. He watched the bridge ahead of him. Although his legs moved mechanically under him, it seemed to come no nearer. The thorn trees were thicker here beside the river, and they gave a little cover from the merciless marksmen on the far bank. Yet men were falling steadily, and the shrapnel raged and cracked above them. "Let's get across. Get the best seats on the other side," Saul shouted beside him. "Come on, then," agreed Sean, and they ran together. They were first onto the bridge, with Aitchison just behind them. Bullets left bright scars on the grey-painted metal, and then suddenly, miraculously, they were across. They had crossed the Tugela. A drainage ditch beside the road, and they dived into it, both of them panting. Sean looked back. Over the bridge poured a mass of khaki, all semblance of order gone, as they crowded into the bottleneck, and the fire from the Boers churned into them. Once across, the leaders fanned out along the river, crouching below the dip of the bank, while behind them the slaughter on the bridge continued. A struggling mass of cursing, running, angry, frightened and dying men. "It's a bloody abattoir." Sean was appalled as he watched it. Dead and wounded men were falling over the low guardrails, splashing into the brown waters of the Tugela, to sink or strike out clumsily for the banks. But a steady stream of men was coming across and going to ground in the two deep drainage ditches and beneath the angle of the river bank. It was clear to Sean that the attack was losing its impetus. As the men jumped down into the ditches, he saw in their faces, and in the way they flattened themselves into the shelter, that they had lost all stomach for the attack. The ordeal of the bridge had destroyed the discipline that had held their steady advance into those neatly controlled ranks. Officers and men were inextricably mixed into a tired and badly frightened rabble. There was no contact between the different groups in the drainage trenches and those lying in the lee of the river banks, and already there was little cover for the men who were still coming across. The fire from the Boer positions never faltered, and now the bridge was blocked with the bodies of the fallen so that each new wave had to climb over them, stepping on dead and wounded alike while the storm of Boer rifle fire lashed them like wind-driven rain. Rivulets of fresh, bright blood dribbled down the supports of the bridge in ghastly contrast to the grey paint, and the surface of the river was stained by a chocolate-brown cloud of it, spreading slowly downstream. Here and there a desperate rallying voice was lifted in the hubbub of incoherent shouts and groans. "Here, the 21st, form on me, the 21st. Independent fire, on the heights, 10 rounds, rapid. Stretcher-bearer!
Bill! Where are you, Bill? Jesus Christ! Jesus! Sobbing Christ!
Up, you men, get up!
Come on, the 21st, fix bayonets!"
Some of them were head and shoulders out of the ditch returning the Boer fire. A few were drinking from their water bottles already. A sergeant struggled with a jammed rifle and swore softly without looking up, while beside him a man sat with his back against the wall of the ditch, his legs sprawled open, and watched while the blood pumped from the wound in his belly. Sean stood and felt the wind of a bullet slap against his cheek, while low in his stomach the slimy reptile of fear coiled itself tighter. Then he scrambled up the side of the ditch. "Come on!" he roared and started running towards the hills. It was open here, like a meadow, and ahead of him an old barbed-wire fence sagged on rotten poles. He reached it, lifted his foot, and kicked with his heel. The fence pole snapped level with the ground. The wire collapsed. He jumped over it. "They're not coming," Saul shouted beside him, and Sean stopped. The two of them were alone in the middle of the field, and the Boer rifles were seeking them eagerly. "Run, Saul, run!" Sean shouted and snatched off his hat. "Come on, you bastards!" He waved at the men behind him. A bullet missed him so narrowly that he staggered in the wind of its passage.
"This way! Follow us! Come on! Come on!"
Saul had not left him. He was dancing with excitement and flapping his arms. "Come back!" Aitchison's voice floated across to them. He stood in the drainage ditch, showing clear from the waist up. "Come back, Courtney!" The attack was finished. Shaun knew it in that instant, and saw the wisdom of Aitchison's decision. Further advance over the open meadowland below the heights was suicide. The resolve that had carried him this far collapsed, and his terror snapped the leash he had held upon it. He ran back blindly, sobbing, leaning forward, his elbows pumping in time to his fear-driven feet. Then suddenly Saul was hit beside him. It took him in the head, threw him forward, his rifle spinning from his hands, squawking hoarsely with pain and surprise as he went down, skidding on his belly. And Shaun ran on.
"Shaun!"
Saul's voice left behind him.
"Shaun!"
A cry of dreadful need. And Shaun closed his mind against it and ran on towards the safety of the ditch.
"Shaun! Please!"
And he checked and stood uncertain with the Mausers barking above and the bullets clipping the grass around him.
"Leave him! Leave him!" shrieked Shaun's terror. "Leave him! Run! Run!"
Saul crawled towards him, blood on his face, and his eyes fastened on Shaun's face.
"Shaun!
Leave him! Leave him!"
But there was hope in that pitiful, blood-smeared face, and the fingers of Saul's hands clawed among the coarse grass roots as he dragged himself forward. It was beyond all reason, but Shaun went back to him. Beneath the spurs of his terror, Shaun found the strength to lift him and run with him. Hating him as he had never hated before, Shaun blundered towards the drainage ditch carrying Saul. The acceleration of his brain slowed down the passage of time so that he seemed to run forever.
"Damn you," he mouthed at Shaun, hating him. "Damn you to hell."
The words came easily from his mouth, an inarticulate expression of his terror. Then the ground gave way beneath his feet, and he fell. Together they dropped into the drainage ditch, and Shaun rolled away from him. He lay on his stomach and pressed his face into the earth and shook as a man shakes in high fever. Slowly he came back from that far place where fear had driven him, and he lifted his head. Saul sat against the bank of the ditch. His face was streaked with a mixture of blood and dirt.
"How are we doing?"
Shaun croaked, and Saul looked at him dully. It was bright and very hot here in the sun. Shaun unscrewed the stopper of his water bottle and held it to Saul's lips. Saul swallowed painfully, and water spilled from the corner of his mouth down his chin and onto his tunic. Then Shaun drank and finished panting with pleasure.
"Let's have a look at your head."
He lifted Saul's hat from his head, and the blood that had accumulated around the sweatband poured in a fresh flood down Saul's neck. Parting the sodden black hair, Shaun found the groove in the flesh of his scalp.
"Grazed you," he grunted, and groped for the field dressing in the pocket of Saul's tunic.
While he bound an untidy turban around Saul's head, he noticed that a strange stillness had fallen on the field, a stillness accentuated rather than broken by the murmur of voices from the men around him and the occasional report of a rifle from the heights above. The battle was over. "At least we got across the river," he thought bitterly. "The only problem that now remains is getting back again. How's that feel?" He had wet his handkerchief and wiped some of the blood and dust from Saul's face. "Thank you, Shaun." Suddenly Shaun realized that Saul's eyes were full of tears, and it embarrassed him. He looked away from them.
"Thank you for coming back to get me."
"Forget it."
"I'll never forget it. Never, never, as long as I live. You'd have done the same." "No, I know, I don't think so. I wouldn't have been able to. I was so scared, Shaun, you'd never know. You'll never know what it's like to be that afraid."
"Forget it, Saul. Leave it alone.
I've got to tell you, I owe it to you. From now on, I owe you. If you hadn't come back, I'd still be out there. I owe you."
"Shut up, damn you!"
He saw that Saul's eyes were different. The pupils had shrunk to tiny black specks, and he was shaking his head in a meaningless, idiotic fashion. The bullet had concussed him. But this could not prevent Shaun's anger.
Shut up! He snarled. You think I don't know about fear? I was so scared out there I hated you. Do you hear that? I hated you. And then Sean's voice softened. He had to explain to Saul and himself. He had to tell him about it, to justify it, and place it securely in the scheme of things. Suddenly he felt very old and wise. In his hand he held the key to the whole mystery of life. It was all so clear. For the first time he understood, and he could explain it. They sat close together in the sun, isolated from the men around them, and Sean's voice sank to an urgent whisper as he tried to make Saul understand, tried to pass on to him this knowledge that embraced all truth. Beside them lay a corporal of the Fusiliers. He lay on his back, dead, and the flies swarmed over his eyes and laid their eggs. They looked like tiny grains of rice clustered in the lashes around his dead, open eyes. Saul leaned heavily against Sean's shoulder. Now and then he shook his head in confusion as he listened to Sean, listened to Sean's voice tripping and stumbling, then starting to hurry as his ideas broke up and crumpled, heard the desperation in it as Sean strove to retain just a few grains of all that knowledge which had been his a few moments before, heard it peter out into silence and sorrow as he found that it was gone. I don't know, Sean admitted at last. Then Saul spoke. His voice was dull and his eyes would not focus properly as he peered at Sean from beneath the blood-soiled turban of bandages. Ruth, he said. You speak like Ruth does. Sometimes in the night when she cannot sleep she tries to tell me. Almost, I understand, almost she finds it and then she stops. I don't know, she says at last. I just don't know. Sean jerked away from him and stared into his face. Ruth? He asked quietly. Ruth, my wife. You'd like her, Sean. She's like you. So brave. She came to me through the Boer lines, all the way from Pretoria, riding alone. She came to me. I couldn't believe it. All that way, she just walked into camp one day and said, Hello, Saul, I'm here. Just like that. You'll like her when you meet her, Sean. She's so beautiful. So serene. In October, when the big winds blow, they come for the first time on a still day. It has been hot and dry for perhaps a month, and then you hear them from far away roaring softly. The roar mounts quickly. The dust races brown on the wind, and the trees lean away from it, threshing and churning their branches. You see it coming, but all your preparations are nothing when it hits. The vast roaring and the dust envelop you, and you are numbed and blinded by the violence of it. In the same way, Sean saw it coming. He recognized it as the murderous rage which before had nearly killed a man, but still he could not prepare himself. And then it was upon him, and the roaring filled his head and narrowed his vision so that all he could see was the face of Saul Freedman. The face was in profile, for Saul was staring back across the plain of Colenso towards the English lines. Sean lifted the dead corporal's rifle and laid it across his lap. With his thumb he slipped off the safety catch, but Saul did not notice the movement. "She's in Pietermaritzburg. I had a letter from her last week," he murmured. And Sean shifted the rifle in his lap so that the muzzle aimed into the side of Saul's chest below the armpit. "I sent her down to Pietermaritzburg. She's staying with her uncle there." Saul lifted his hand and touched his head. Sean curled his finger on the trigger. "I wish you could meet her, Sean. She'd like you." Now he looked into Sean's face, and there was such pathetic trust in his eyes. When I write, I'm going to tell her about today, about what you did. Sean took up the slack in the trigger until he could feel the final resistance. We both owe you, Saul stopped and smiled shyly. I just want you to know that I'll never forget it. Kill him, roared Sean's head. Kill him now, kill him quickly, don't let him talk.
It was the first conscious command his instinct had issued.
Now, do it now.
But his trigger finger relaxed.
This is all that stands between you and Ruth. Do it now.
The roaring in his head abated. The big wind had passed by, and he could hear it receding. He lifted the rifle and slowly pushed the safety catch across. In the stillness after the wind, he knew suddenly that from now on, Saul Freedman was his special charge, because he had come so close to taking it from him. Saul's life had become a debt of honour. He laid the rifle aside and closed his eyes wearily. "We'd better think about getting out of here," he said quietly. "Otherwise I might never get around to meeting this beauty of yours."